I think this is an obvious puzzle piece. What we now know are the details, which largely corroborate the confession of Holmes.
A new twist in the Fairbanks 4 case. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, August 21st. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, a village waits for law enforcement to make an arrest in a murder case.
To me, it was hard on me. I mean, she's my age, and I felt like he was out there, and I was scared.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
And by
The Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
A man has been sentenced to 359 years in jail for the beating deaths of an elderly couple and the sexual assault of a 2-year-old child in Anchorage. KTUU reports Jerry Active claimed innocence during today's sentencing and said he didn't receive a fair trial. He was found guilty in April of 10 felony charges, including 2 counts of first-degree murder and multiple counts of sexual assault. Active was 24 when he was accused of the May 25, 2013 beating deaths of a couple in their 70s. Active was also accused of sexually assaulting the woman he killed, her 2-year-old family member, and her 91-year-old mother. Statements undermining murder convictions of the so-called Fairbanks Four were briefly published in an online Fairbanks Daily Newsminer article. The web story, which was quickly taken down by the paper today, shares leaked court documents outlining long-sealed statements about the 1997 murder of John Hartman. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The statements about the Hartman case were made by Jason Wallace to Public Defender's Office staff in 2003 when he was facing trial for an unrelated killing. According to what's in the Newsminer article, Wallace said he and 2 high school friends randomly attacked 15-year-old John Hartman on a downtown street in October 1997. It corroborates in some details a 2011 confession to the killing by another jailed murderer and former friend, William Holmes. Wallace and Holmes blamed the actual beating on the other, saying a group of friends, not the Fairbanks Four, attacked Hartman. Wallace's attorney, Jason Gazewood, was not available for comment. 3 of the 4 men actually convicted of the Hartman murder remain jailed. George Fries, Kevin Pease, and Eugene Vent. The 4th, Marvin Roberts, got out on parole earlier this summer. It's unclear how the Newsminer got the court documents containing Wallace's statements about the killing and why the paper pulled their story. Newsminer editor Rod Boyce did not reply to a request for comment Friday morning. Fairbanks 4 advocate April Monroe Frick says she's disappointed the story was pulled and posted a copy of it to her blog, Free the Fairbanks 4.
I think this is an obvious puzzle piece. It's been apparent from kind of the veiled references for a long time that there were statements by Jason Wallace made to public officials sworn to be agents of justice that had been kept secret for a long time. What we now know are the details, which largely corroborate the confession of Holmes.
Monroe Frick says the release is not likely to affect what happens in actual court. Wallace has appealed to the Alaska Supreme Court to block use of his statements by Fairbanks 4 attorneys as part of their request for post-conviction relief. An evidentiary hearing in the broader case is scheduled for October. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The community of Chebec in southwest Alaska has been breathing a collective sigh of relief after the arrest of a man in July for the murder of Roxanne Smart. The 19-year-old was found stabbed to death in the middle of town last August. As Dacia Eaton with KYUK in Bethel reports, it's been a tough year for the tight-knit Chupik community as they waited for law enforcement to make an arrest.
Carrie Tall leads me to a memorial beside the old Chebec Health Clinic, where her friend was found.
So this is kind of a busy, is this the main roadway here?
Yes.
So it was just one building in from the main roadway.
Yes.
So sort of a very busy spot.
But at night it's not that busy. At night it's a different story.
Tall explains there's a midnight curfew for four-wheelers, the main form of transportation here, so there would have been fewer people around when Roxanne Smart was killed in the middle of the night. A wooden cross bearing her name leans up against the building supports, along with a black and brown stuffed animal puppy. a coffee mug covered in forget-me-nots, and personal notes weighted down with rocks. Tal says Smart was a quiet woman who loved her new baby and had a soft spot for dogs. And Tal says she can't think of why anyone would want to hurt her.
She was really shy, quiet. She always had a puppy to play with. And she didn't deserve any of what she received.
What led up to Smart's murder isn't clear, but court documents say she was found naked from the waist down and stabbed multiple times in the neck and chest. Alaska State Troopers reportedly arrived soon after and took DNA samples from several suspects.
To me, it was hard on me. I mean, she's my age, and I felt like he was out there, and I was scared.
Tal didn't want to sit idle and started a Facebook page to keep attention on Smart's case before it went cold. She and two other women from CHEVAC kept the page updated with images of their friend, calling it Justice for Roxanne Smart. The town had to live for nearly a year with a killer among them while they waited for the lab samples to come back. Lieutenant Christopher Thompson, the deputy commander of the Alaska Bureau of Investigation, who oversees all major crime investigations, didn't want to go on tape for this story. But he says investigators went to CHEVAC three times between August 2014 and July 2015 and identified several people of interest in the case. He says a rape kit was administered. No arrests were made.
Is that the store, the main store there?
Yeah.
Tal walks me past the bustling corporation store to her auntie's house, which is kitty corner to the old health clinic where Smart's body was found. Her auntie, Etta Tal, says Roxanne was a regular at her teen nights, where she did positive activities with young people.
She was with my youth group in the beginning. She did the fried bread power day. We had a fried bread power day, and she was so happy. If I would ever do a program, she would always want to be there to help out. She was that kind of a person.
On July 23rd, investigators returned to CHEVAC to interview Samuel Achuk, one of the original people of interest. Investigators say the 19-year-old admitted to placing Smart in a chokehold that night with his arms until she blacked out and to raping her. But he denied stabbing or killing Smart. The next day, while he was being arrested and charged for assault and sexual assault, an affidavit says Achuk admitted to stabbing and murdering Smart that night. Tal says that changed the dynamic in CHEVAC.
I think it's like a relief and a release. When I first heard about it, it was very thick here. You know, the atmosphere was different. But now I come back, I can feel like a relief here in CHEVAC.
My biggest question is why it took 11 months for the DNA testing to take place.
Larry Barker is the superintendent of the Kashinimut School District in CHEVAC. He says everyone wonders what took so long.
Because it did leave the village with the concerns and lots of questions. You know, no arrests were taking place, and the whole village was wondering what was going on, and, you know, probably a little scared.
Troopers say it took 11 months to charge the suspect because they were waiting on DNA samples that were first sent to the state crime lab and then to another out-of-state lab for further analysis. Senator Berta Gardner has called for an audit of Alaska's crime lab, citing a huge backlog, specifically of rape kits. Lieutenant Thompson with the troopers says the last lab report came back June 25th, which gave investigators enough evidence to confront Achuk in July. Troopers say more details will come out in court. Achuk was arraigned in Bethel Superior Court August 4th. He pleaded not guilty. His case will be back in court in October. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Juneau woman talks about the transition that took her more than 30 years to make.
Before I actually started this process, I was merely existing in the world. Now I am actually alive, and the difference is quite amazing.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Alaska Pacific University offers personalized education with real-world experiences to prepare graduates to be leaders in their communities. Details at 1-800-ALASKA-U or alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Search teams in Sitka are racing the clock this afternoon as they work to find the third victim of Tuesday's landslide before a new storm arrives tonight. The National Weather Service is forecasting heavy rain and wind in Sitka this weekend. Officials say the weather will make it unsafe for work crews, as more rain could cause more slides. Meanwhile, officials today released the names of the two landslide victims whose bodies were recovered on Wednesday and Thursday. They were identified as brothers Elmer and Ulysses Diaz, who were working on the house on Kramer Avenue that was destroyed in Tuesday's landslide. Teams are still searching for the third missing man, William Stortz, Sitka's building official. Deputy Fire Chief Al Stevens, who's running the recovery work, says recovery teams have a very small window in which to finish their work, and it's rapidly closing.
My full intention as the incident commander is that I intend to pull all crews out approximately 8 o'clock tonight. If it rains, the rains come sooner, I'm gonna pull them out sooner. We're gonna pull all equipment, all crews out, obviously for safety reasons.
Stevens says he expects to halt all work through the weekend until his team can reassess weather conditions. Trained dogs working with the Juneau-based search team Sea Dogs had called attention to a site on Thursday where officials hoped to find William Stortz. But Stevens says that as of this afternoon, dogs had also indicated several other sites, and crews are working on all of them.
As you can imagine, you know, this is a rather deep, with mud, water, logs, and you don't just come in and scoop a big chunk out and call it good. You have to methodically and meticulously pull one piece out at a time. And we have spotters in there that have to look at what's happening. And this is why it's taken so long.
The National Weather Service is predicting up to 3 inches of rain in the next 36 to 48 hours, but that's still significantly less intense than the storm on Tuesday, which is estimated to have dropped more than 2.5 inches in just 6 hours at sea level. Much more rain likely fell higher up the mountain where the slide started. Alaska has already outgrown the $250 million Goose Creek Correctional Center that opened in 2012. People testified during a field hearing in Anchorage for the U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs on Thursday. They said it'd be smarter to put some of the money that goes into building and maintaining prisons toward keeping people out of them instead. KNBA's Jocelyn Estes has more.
U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska chaired the field hearing on strengthening Alaska Native families, examining recidivism, reentry, and tribal courts in Alaska. She heard a range of solutions from the five people invited to testify. First, she shared some information from a report.
Back in 2009, for the first time in 38 years, it says 26 states successfully reduced their prison populations. But Alaska was not one of those.
The status quo in our villages is unacceptable in any civilized country, is unacceptable in America and in Alaska.
Natasha Singh is general counsel for the Interior Alaska Regional Nonprofit Tanana Chiefs Conference. She says Alaska's law enforcement and judicial system is not working for rural Alaska. Greg Razzo, who serves on the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission and the boards of Alaska Legal Services and the Alaska Native Justice Center, agrees.
We have seen where a centralized justice system is simply unable to meet the needs of the widespread Alaskan populations and unable to understand the cultures and the history and the spirit of the people that live in rural Alaska.
Singh says tribal courts are required to protect constitutional and civil rights, work well, and need to be expanded.
Today we ask you add to the tools Alaska tribal governments need to strengthen our families and to address the root causes of substance abuse, What is needed is federal legislation which recognizes the authority of our tribal governments to deal in the first instance with issues of local domestic violence, sexual assault, and substance abuse.
Alaska Senate Majority Leader John Coghill of Fairbanks endorses tribal courts.
In the process of time, the Native groups and the tribal groups have begun what I'd call a pretty decent justice system that I would say is maturing. And the state has had some struggles, there's no doubt about it, how to work with them legally, technically.
Jeff Jesse, the head of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, says 60% of Alaska's prison population has mental and behavioral health issues. As for the people relapsing into crime after they leave prison, Jesse says the solutions involve more than the departments of public safety and law.
You know who are the agencies that really have a huge impact on keeping them out when they leave? It's Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. It's the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. It's the Department of Health and Social Services. It's our tribal partners. Because what we know is to keep people productive in the community, they need housing, employment, and support for recovery.
Murkowski told the audience of about 30 people the public record for the hearing will remain open for a few weeks if anyone wishes to submit written testimony. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
The State Department of Natural Resources held a public hearing in Anchorage today to get additional comments on pending applications for water rights to a tributary of the Chewitna River. The Chewitna watershed on the west side of Cook Inlet has become the focus of a dispute over the use of water in Middle Creek. The small creek is a salmon stream, and the Chewitna Citizens Coalition has filed for water rights there. But Pack Rim Coal has plans to use that water in its proposed mining operation in the area, and the company's water reservation application is pending. The dispute has been percolating since 2009, when the Citizens Coalition first filed for the water rights, saying the salmon stream must be protected. DNR did not take action on the application. The coalition sued, and in 2013, a state superior court judge ruled that DNR's refusal to process the application amounted to an unreasonable delay, and it violated the coalition's constitutional right to due process. Now, DNR is under the gun to make a decision on the competing water rights applications. Friday's hearing brought together representatives from both conservation and development organizations. DNR's Brent Goodrum, director of the Division of Mining, Land, and Water, says the department must consider 8 criteria in making the decision, among them economic and environmental factors.
That's the crux of the issue here, and I think that's why it's such a tough decision to make. That's why we're spending time in process and spending time in this hearing today to gather additional information so that DNR can make the best decision it has based upon all information available.
DNR must make a decision by October 6th.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska oil and gas have a huge impact on all of us, but how much do you really know about them? At akoilandgas.com, you can take an oil and gas IQ quiz and get the facts from reliable sources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
Broken hips and head injuries can have life-altering effects, especially for older adults. But no matter how old you are, it's important to be physically active to prevent injuries. Activity can also increase your strength, balance, and can be done at any age. Ask your healthcare provider about activities that will improve your health. Learn more about starting a new activity at injuryprevention.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, transitioning. It's been a year since Juneau resident Jennifer Fletcher started to publicly present herself as a woman, and less than 2 years since she first started to shed her male identity and rebuild herself as female. But the inner journey to get to that point started long before then. KTOO's Lisa Fu sat down with Fletcher and has this story.
Jennifer Fletcher used to spend up to 5 hours a day escaping reality.
She'd play games on the computer, visit websites for the transgender community.
Pretty much anything I could do to not focus on the present, not focus on how things actually were, so that I could actually at least attempt to function throughout the rest of the day.
She'd go through binge and purge cycles of cross-dressing. She regularly thought about suicide. Fletcher was severely depressed.
I was continuously hiding who I was and trying to quite literally leave no mark on the world.
Fletcher is 33 and moved to Juneau as a teenager. On any given Friday night now, you can almost always find her at Social Night, run by SIGLA, the Southeast Alaska Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Organization in Juneau. But it took her a long time to realize she was transgender, even though signs throughout her life pointed to it.
Let's just say that I had consistently wished from the time I was about 12, on every star, on every birthday, that I'd wake up as a female version of myself.
As an adolescent, she'd wear her mother's clothes when she was home by herself, taking items from the laundry so no one would notice. Fletcher was 14 when she first tried to castrate herself. She tried again when she was 15.
I was actively envying pretty much all of the girls who were going through their own puberties, their own processes, and just not very happy with what was going on. While I have occasionally temporarily appreciated having things like facial hair or, you know, greater strength or things of that sort, they just aren't me.
But in her teens, she refused to consider she was transgender. Fletcher went to high school in Juneau, but was born in Laramie, Wyoming, where gay college student Matthew Shepard was murdered in 1998. She learned being different wasn't safe. She saw transgender individuals on talk shows where they were mocked and laughed at.
At that point in time, society was teaching individuals like myself that, no, it's not okay to be. That if you want to actually have any chance at happiness, that you had better suppress what's going on and you had better hope that you aren't really.
Fletcher says finally deciding to transition almost 2 years ago didn't stem from courage, but from an utter sense of fear.
I was faced with what I thought were basically two alternatives, death or transition. Whether it would have been death by suicide or by the slow gradual path of alcoholism or whatever other coping mechanisms I attempted to use that would have inevitably failed.
She chose transition. Fletcher dropped what she calls the male mask and started rebuilding herself. She came out to close family and friends and started dressing as a woman at social functions. Fletcher eventually started the medical process and taking hormones. At each step, she was so afraid of rejection.
Almost all of the hurdles I've experienced in my transition have been, I'd say, self-imposed. They've all been fears that may have had a legitimate base, but had invariably been blown completely out of proportion into these vast monsters that seemed like I'd be incapable of standing against.
When I ask Fletcher what her prior first name was, she doesn't tell me.
Not particularly relevant, I don't think.
She says there tends to be an overemphasis on who people once were or appeared to be.
I had been looking at some old photos of myself and actually opted to post some of them on Facebook. Just kind of show how very different a person I am now. One of my friends actually said outright that they felt they were looking at a dead person, which I think actually sums up how I was viewing those photos as well.
She does a lot of things she used to do before she transitioned, like rock climb, play board games, read. But she says her priorities have shifted.
Before I actually started this process, I was merely existing in the world. And to be honest, waiting to die. Now I am actually alive. And the difference is quite amazing.
And she wants to make a difference. Fletcher helps to run a transgender support group in Juneau called the Trans Alaska Pipeline. She wants to make finding medical and professional resources easier. She wants to help others avoid some of the internal conflict she had and help them face their fears, one monster at a time. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. Gary Hanchett is a do-everything kind of Alaskan. He's the vice mayor of Bettles, the backup postmaster, election chair, tour guide, and trapper. He tells us about some of the more notorious summer residents of Bettles, the mosquitoes.
The the first part of mosquito season, I would have to say the end of May through June and into July. But the first part of that period is the worst. So you never go anywhere without bug dope. When people first get here, it drives them nuts at first. We see people come in that work for the Park Service in the summertime, and some of them just never get used to it. They can't stand it. And there's nothing you can do to convince them. Look, just don't pay any attention to them. You know, swat them if they land on you, but, you know, you don't have to stampede. You're not a caribou. They're not warble flies. So, you know, my main reason for being here is because there's not a whole lot of other people here. It's not that I'm antisocial. I just love the country. I use the expression, the only way I can portray how beautiful it is say that it stops time for me. And you look out and, you know, you're out there and there's nothing around you. It seems to stop the clock.
Gary Hanchett lives in Bettles, Alaska. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. If you want to tell your story, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Lisa Fu, Annie Feit, and Monica Goki. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tisha Eaton in Chebec, Rachel Waldholtz in Sitka, Jacqueline X. Estes and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Ann Hillman. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
These days, being into STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, doesn't make a girl a geek. It makes the world a better place. If you like numbers, nature, computers, and figuring out how the world really works, go to beanengineeralaska.com. You just might like what you learn. And it's not just for girls. This message on Alaska Public Media brought to you by ExxonMobil in Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.